in the studio. Excuse me, folks, while I cough up my flu injection. In the studio with us, though, is Rebecca Oral Trigg. She is a PhD student in the ARC Centre of Excellence for the Future of Low Energy Electronics Technology at Monash University. Rebecca, welcome to Triple R.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to see you. And your work is, I mean, Ray's going to go nuts about this because he's a chemical engineer, so he's going to freak out.
Good.
One of the things I found fascinating is there's so many ways in which people are synthesizing materials at the moment. But you, in particular, are using liquid metals. Talk us through what we mean by that. I mean, a lot of people would imagine that all these things are made by heating up metals and, you know, just making materials. So what's different about your approach?
Liquid metals basically are metals that are liquid at room temperature.
Right.
Mercury is probably the one that people are most familiar with. Or basically we can take metals that are solid and melt them, basically. Lots of what we call nanomaterials. So materials that are basically on the order of 10 to the minus 9 meters thick.
Mm-hmm.
Currently are made with really big machines and, like, you know, very complicated processes, and while they make very good materials, they're not really kind of, I suppose, that commercial yet.
Okay.
And so one of the things we do with liquid metals is we actually use the processes that they naturally undergo.
Okay.
So one of the things that we do a lot of is we make metal oxides. So one people are most familiar with, if you've gone outside, will be rust. So that's iron oxide. And that happens basically when iron is exposed to oxygen. And when you have liquid metals, because they themselves have some really cool properties, like they're conductive, some of them magnetic, but also when they're liquid, you can actually use them as a reaction environment themselves.
Okay, right. Yeah.
So
so you're mixing in the metal.
Yeah,
itself.
Basically. Yeah.
Without heating it up.
Yeah, we can do it without heating it up. Yeah. So a very common one we use is a metal called gallium,
mm-hmm.
Which it basically melts at around 30 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
And we can actually alloy other metals into that to make some really cool things. And most of those are the oxides, but you can also make other things like sulfides when you react them with like sulfur or hydrogen sulfide gas. Or the other cool thing is you can make the oxides and then turn them into other things, which can be very useful as well.
So when we think about making things out of liquid metals, I mean, one of the things you mentioned was the size, so
yes.
The nanometer size. Yeah. So, I mean, just for people's perspective, the human hair is 50,000 nanometers wide.
Yes,
so you're talking about a few nanometers.
Yeah, so I'm talking about a few billionths of a meter. Mm. It's quite hard to conceptualize.
Yeah. And this is a few atoms wide sort of stuff around that.
Or in some of our work, we're really trying to make atomically thin materials, so it's just one atom thick.
One atom thick.
Yeah.
And with that, how is it that my question really is around why would you use the liquid metal sort of approach as opposed to a more top-down, I will deliver one atom at a time to build up a structure?
Well, really, I guess it's kind of the scalability, but also the time constraints. Because if you're depositing one atom at a time, you know, that takes a lot of resources, for one. But also, you know, it takes a really long time. Whereas when we take advantage of the natural processes, it's very quick. And you can basically make lots and lots of these materials in a very short space of time. Mm.
So I just want to back up about where you said you might make a thin material. So if we're making, you could think, a coating or a thin film, that's in semiconductor processing. That's how we make microchips, where you can lay down, if you have a flat surface using complicated machinery, and normally high vacuums and like plasmas and cool things like that, or electron beams, you can deposit atomically, not individual atomics, but very thin nanometer films. They have to be on something. They're stuck to something. Now, what you're talking about is this area of 2D materials. And I would like you to, the thing to point out is you can make something that's flat and atomically thin. It's not stuck to anything.
Well, yeah, we have a couple of processes for that, actually. So the main method that we use is something that we call the bubbling technique, where you basically take a small amount of the liquid metal and bubble just air through it. The metal reacts with the oxygen in the air, and then you have a layer of water on top, and basically the bubble bursts, And with the sheet, with the 2D materials already formed because they've reacted already, and it just floats up into the water and you can basically collect them and put them on whatever you like. Mm. Another method we have is a method of printing directly onto a substrate, which is a method we call touch printing, which is basically where you take a small like droplet of the metal and we put that in a very low oxygen environment, so say 10 parts per million, and that forms a skin just on the top, and then we can actually just touch the whatever substrate you want and it will come off and stick.
How do the properties of these materials change when you get to that sort of thickness? Because one of the things that I suppose is we think about metals, we think of hard objects. So if you get it really thin, I'd be thinking brittle. Is that the case, or are these...
Well, no, they're often quite flexible, actually, because it's not the metal itself, it's the metal oxide.
Mm.
And so one of the things we're looking at is printing on, say, like a flexible glass or flexible mica. Yeah. And so it's one of those things where we could have maybe flexible electronics. So, phones currently, you have an indium tin oxide,
okay,
which is used in touchscreens and things like that. So if we could have something of that that's just one atom thick, then it could be bendable and stretchable, or maybe not stretchable, but bendable, definitely.
Bendable. Yeah.
So that opens a whole range of other technologies and avenues up. Mm. Yeah.
So your description of your bubbler, where you're bubbling a bubble through a liquid metal and it bursts and you get this cool coating that breaks into pieces, that means you're constraining how it can grow. So yes. A lot of metal oxides from, say, the ways they might do a nanofabrication, they can't make them thin films. Are there materials where you're making something you don't normally find in nature?
Definitely, yeah. These ones are ones that we really don't find in nature at all. So one of the things I was working with was tin oxide. And there's a couple of forms of that. There's tin monoxide and tin dioxide. And what we found is that when it's in nature, it's basically all tin dioxide. That's just what forms. But with these processes, we can actually catch it in those very early stages and make tin monoxide. So basically by adjusting the conditions, we can make things that really don't exist in nature.
Mm. That's super cool. One of the things that I love when you get down to the nanoscale is how these materials change. And as you say, they're flexible. The one that sticks with me is gold, and it's not gold in colour when you get to a
certain
thing. Like it changes
red,
colour.
Yeah.
Yeah, it changes colour, which is like so counterintuitive to our entire life experience. With that idea that many of these materials have very freaky and amazing properties when you get down to these sorts of scales, is there the potential for us to sort of offset the need for some of the rare earths and other materials that we don't have much of when you get to this sort of specificity with production?
Quite possibly, yeah. So a lot of the materials that we've looked at are something called topological insulators,
mm-hmm,
which is where if you have a lump of it, the majority of it is going to be an insulating material. But the very surface layer, which is the layer we're interested in, is actually conductive.
Okay.
And so because it's only a single layer, it's conductive only in two dimensions because the electrons can't go further into the material. So it has a very low resistivity. And so that's really interesting because, I mean, you were talking about the helium shortage before. So if we could have very low resistivity materials at sort of more like room temperatures, then it might lessen our need for those kind of really extraordinary materials that are very difficult to find.
Now, Rebecca, people probably, I'm not sure if they heard my intro, but you're a PhD student, so into some pretty cool stuff already.
Yep.
How long have you got to go?
Most of it. I'm only 3 months in.
Wow.
It's very new, but it's good.
Well, look, it sounds like a really interesting set of projects, and this stuff I think is just, it's fascinating. If you look at the history of how we've just changed the way we produce materials over the last 30, 40 years, I mean, again, we're getting into that acceleration of changing the way we produce materials again with the sort of work your group is doing. So thanks so much for coming in and chatting to us, and maybe we'll talk to you in 3 years when you've done some work.
Yeah, when I'm actually a doctor.
That sounds great. Rebecca Orrell Trigg is a PhD student in the ARC Centre of Excellence for Future Low Energy Electronics Technology at Monash University. We're going to take a break for some important station announcements, folks, and we'll be back in just a few moments with our second guest for today, talking about some funky new work in epilepsy research.